Hi, this is John Udell. My guest today is Ellen Ullman. She started out as an English major, became a successful programmer, and then began writing about life lived, as the title of her first book put it, Close to the Machine. Published in 1995, that book is still, for me, one of the best insider accounts of life as a software developer. Her novel, The Bug, was published in 2003, and she's at work on a new novel now. We got together to talk about how living close to the machine affects programmers and how their work affects everyone else. So I had the idea to talk to you for a variety of reasons, but mainly it's that you've just sort of been popping up on my radar screen in various ways. And so I wound up rereading Close to the Machine, which it was the one that was serialized in Harper's?
No, there were two excerpts in Salon.
A Salon. Mm-hmm. But you were in Harper's or The Atlantic as well, right?
Not The Atlantic, but I don't have association with them, but I have a kind of several pieces, reading and an essay, and a good relationship with the man who's now the editor of Harper's.
Oh, okay. What was great about that is that it just, well, there hasn't since been, and then never had been, anyone who brought those perspectives together, I don't think.
Not at that time.
Yeah, and I think mostly still that's true. This job description of programmer/novelist is extremely interesting to me.
Bizarre.
It was bizarre, but I think really interesting, and we talked before a little bit about some of the reasons why arguably it's actually pretty important, and so I wanted to start there, and then we'll let this go where it wants to go.
Sure.
I particularly liked your notion about where the contempt comes from. This issue of contempt is something that I've been drawing attention to a lot lately. It just becomes more and more clear to me that there's something here that we're not paying enough attention to when we hear IT people dismiss their clientele as clueless users.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've had this conversation both from the IT perspective and from the perspective of the folks on the other side of the fence. It's been clear to me that this is a problem, but I hadn't really at all analyzed where, what the source of that was. And so I thought that your point about, well, why don't you sort of explain, because people who will be listening to this haven't read our email exchange in advance, but I thought that, that would be a good place to start.
The problem is that when you program, you're isolated. The job is a very isolating one. And what happens is, well, depending whether you work in what's called a user shop, that's a corporation, or a software developer shop, you're kind of bombarded with requirements, very loosely stated, and they keep changing. People have all these ideas about what software should be, and the problem is they don't know how to program. Now, things are getting better. Since I first wrote about this, people more and more can do the simple programming and get put up a website for themselves, which is a huge step forward.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, the more complicated software is done by people who are specialists. And there is this big divide between the people who know how to program and the people asking them to make something. And the problem is that there isn't enough interchange between those two people. The programmers are off sitting there alone in their cubicle, grumbling, and the deadlines are ridiculous, always. The requirements go up, and the time you have to do it goes down. And so after a while, the sense of this being the people out there and what they want become oppressive. And it's very, very hard to think of them as people you want to work with and people you want to please.
Well, from where I sit, there is beginning to be a productive discussion about how it can be that we can create a language which is intermediate between the mindset of the what we call business clientele and, on the other hand, the software developers. We don't have any really good examples of what that's going to be yet, but I have certainly noticed over the last couple of years that there's agreement on both sides that that would be a good thing to get to, and lots of interest in moving in that direction, whatever it turns out to be. But the point that you made that I thought was...
Let me just say one thing,
yeah, okay.
Though. I think there is a model. It isn't the piece of software, but it is a model of how good software could work. The spreadsheet.
Yeah.
You can use a spreadsheet to just line up columns. That's all.
And in fact, that's how it mostly is used.
Most people use it that way, but those more adventuresome and more interested in diving into the complexities of spreadsheets can do amazingly complicated things, which is programming. And there are intermediate steps. You know, people learn how to do a sum on a column and a subtotal. And so they can go stepwise into the depths of the tool.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's the model of what the software should be, that you can use it right out of the box, the sort of easy user interface, you know, the 20-minute up and running. And then, for those who care to do more, they can step down and down and down. I don't mean into the operating system, because that is specialist work.
Mm-hmm.
But into the depths of actual programming and understanding how to tell a computer the complexities of what's in your mind and go what if, and try things without a lot of consequence.
Yeah, yeah.
You can fail without a lot of consequence.
It's also the case that we've yet to fully explore the way in which the spreadsheet can be this common ground on which these two groups can come together. And one of my all-time heroes, Ward Cunningham, who, among other things, has now been advancing this idea that he calls FIT, which I think is Framework for Integrated Test. But, you know, fundamentally, what this is a way of using a wiki to, on the one hand, enable the business specifiers to model the scenarios that they wish to be implemented, and at the same time, to drive software tests directly off of that same wiki. And in fact, the wiki is really just used to model these things as tables. And all of that flows from Ward's experience way back when doing this in the context of spreadsheets.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he observed that the business people would tend to model these scenarios in their spreadsheets, and he had the insight, well, why don't we just use that directly? Pull the tests right out of there and inject the results right back in there.
Right.
Now we've got some kind of notion of testable business logic.
And also there are easy prototyping tools for user interfaces. And the problem is, though, that the people on the business end or who represent the user, let's say in a software developer, so now there's the problem. When you're working in a startup company, there really isn't a good user representative on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
The user representative is usually some kind of visionary who has these kind of very big but not very specific ideas of what should be done.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to collaborate with anybody. The marketing people, or, you know, they're like, well, give me the sky and a list of features. So they're not really sitting down in that deep way. So maybe you're right. In a corporate setting, if, this is the big if, somebody on the user side is assigned to do this. They used to be called systems analysts. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
Are there still systems analysts?
I haven't heard the phrase in a while. So
well, that's what
that
they were people who were technical enough, but also represented one or two or three user departments, and it was their job to kind of span the divide.
Mm-hmm.
And there needs to be a sort of person like that.
Well, how do you feel about the proposition that, to the extent that we are increasingly doing software development out in the open on networks, in such an incremental and iterative fashion that we're modifying our applications hour by hour or even minute by minute based on our observations of how people are using them?
It's disconcerting to the user, I think.
You think?
You know, this online software, you know, it used to be that you bought some software and it was yours, right? And you could keep whatever version you liked and you could just keep using it because you had made a relationship with that piece of software.
Uh-huh.
And, okay, there may be things you wanted you couldn't have, but it's like all relationships. You know, you accept the good and the bad, and if the good outweighs it, you keep it.
Mm-hmm.
These days, with these online apps, you know, you go and you use something, and you become an expert user. You know, you just know exactly what you want, click, click, you go around, you log on one day, it's gone.
It's all different, yeah. That
it's all
happen.
Different. You're like, oh my God, I'm just thrown back to being a starter.
Yeah, well, that's the downside.
That is very disconcerting. And this idea of showing the beta in between maybe softens that blow, but it keeps the user constantly thrown back into starting over and being a first-time user.
Right, although I would argue that there's a huge distinction here between what my bank did, for example, the last time it revved its online system, which was really version 1 to version 2, lots of change, very discontinuous mm-hmm. transition. And that was very disruptive to me and very annoying. On the other hand, there are a number of online applications and services that I use that evolve so gradually and so incrementally that I don't even have a sense day by day that they are evolving. But if I step back, it's like watching your kid grow. You know, you can see. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that
I haven't experienced that.
It's happening in all of the Google apps, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're right, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that page, that front page that used to just be a big white sheet, is just things keep appearing on it.
Yeah, well, and in,
yes,
and,
but
and,
without treading upon the original functionality.
Yeah.
It grows around it. Like, I don't know if you were a kid, you had these things where you put a string in kind of sugar water and it made crystals.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that. There are things crystallizing around it, but the core thing is still there,
unchanged. Yeah, yeah.
So, again, it is that kind of spreadsheet model. You know, you can always use that simple thing if that's what you want to do.
Yeah.
If you want to explore, if you want to use the maps, if you want to import, you know, use the maps and applications, all the things that people are doing, which is programming in it, which is glorious. That, to me, is utterly glorious.
Yeah. But before I forget, I want to come back to this contempt issue because I thought that what you said in email was really interesting and I hadn't ever heard it put this way before, which is that it is necessary to, from the standpoint of defensive programming,
mm-hmm.
assume that the person who's driving your interface is a retarded monkey.
Right. When I, you know, built front ends all many years ago, starting from scratch, you know, you just look at it and the only way you test it is really you just put your fist on it and roll around.
Mm-hmm.
In order to make it robust, you have to assume that the person on the other end is like maybe a baby jumping on the keyboard.
Yeah.
And so gradually, in your mind, this image of this kind of idiot on the other side grows. And it's hard to shake that because you've spent all your time thinking of that the person could do anything, the most illogical thing in the world, and you have to defend against it.
Indeed. And some people will, right? I mean, so it's...
Absolutely. Or by mistake. Something falls on the keyboard. You know,
right.
you can't let the software crash because of that.
Right.
So you gradually start to think of the person on the other end is not a person, but some kind of stupid process.
And the relationship as being adversarial.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because, as I said, you have to defend the system.
Mm-hmm.
That's your job. You know, there's this person who's attacking it, and you have to make sure that it does not come down.
Yeah, yeah. So one of my hopes for this online incremental model of software development is that we can move into a more collaborative mode where developers are observing the things that you do, both in the way of making mistakes, but also in the way of using your systems in ways that they hadn't anticipated and which
right.
indicate to them possibilities that hadn't occurred to them, and that there's some hope that this is going to get us to a less adversarial and a more mm-hmm. collaborative relationship.
I hope you're right, but then there's something else driving it the other way. There's a kind of onslaught of complexity from the programmer standpoint. You know, we'll probably, you know, change the internet protocol, so there'll be some changes there. All this software in this current phase was built to preserve the scarce resource, which was bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we used to, write software. Well, there wasn't enough disk space. Well, then there wasn't enough memory, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the day I asked my boss, I said, well, you know, how much memory should I think we'll have? And he said, think of it as infinite. And it was like, wow. So all this software written now was written around the, like, well, you know, there might be a bandwidth problem. You couldn't assume. Now, so we're going to go into another environment where bandwidth will be wide and ubiquitous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that will be a whole change in how the software works. And so all these things that looked logical when you wrote it for the scarce resource will now look like, why did you do that? It'll be like Y2K. Why in the world did they do that?
Mm-hmm. Can you think of any other... I've been trying to think of a word other than user.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I have been failing.
Right. Yes, you're right. I mean, here we are... where the person on the other end is a user.
Right. as has been observed, right, there are basically two groups who talk about users and they're drug dealers and programmers. It's
mm-hmm.
it's not a pleasant situation.
I can't think of another word. And it just, you know, what happens is these things get so ingrained
mm-hmm.
and it's hard to back out of established ideas.
Mm-hmm.
My concern mostly is not so much on the, you know, programmer to user level, but on it's kind of what's happening on the social level now. I mean, I've always thought that the interior of the software has a way of filtering out and making the users look like the technology.
Mm-hmm.
I saw one of these Dear Abbeys where this woman was asking her boyfriend for, you know, his undivided attention,
mm-hmm.
which he thought was just, why? Why should you have undivided attention? it just seemed beyond him. Since, well, one's attention is now so split all the time.
Yeah.
And this has now become a way of life. You know, people talk to you and they're texting, you know.
Yeah.
They're answering the phone and they're driving and eating and talking on the cell phone. It's just become a way of life that it kind of horrifies me, I have to say.
But actually, if given that your part of your line of thinking here is that it is, in fact, programmers who have built the technological landscape in their own image.
In the machine's image and according to their own desires.
And according to their own desires. And given that their desire is very much not to be interrupted. Right. Not to tolerate multitasking and force all communication into asynchronous modes mm-hmm. so as to not disturb long periods of concentration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd have to say that the phenomenon of continuous partial attention is...
But that's coming from the technology. I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
I mean, there are instances where just the structure of the technology determines how people begin to behave.
Mm-hmm.
So... The more the technology allows you to do more than one thing at a time, the more people will do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, this is not the programmer's desires. The programmer's desires are to have most of their life machine mediated. That has happened in the world,
mm-hmm.
God knows.
Mm-hmm.
Programmers don't like to meet face-to-face. More and more of social life does not involve face-to-face meeting.
Mm-hmm.
It's people talk through their web pages now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, well, that saddens me. And I just wonder what will happen now in the world. Can people sit down and read a book anymore? I mean, that takes cutting off the world and sitting down and having complicated thoughts in an uninterrupted way. And what will happen in a world where people find that less and less appealing?
There is beginning to be considerable backlash against continuous partial attention.
Mm-hmm.
So Linda Stone, who was, I don't think still is at Microsoft anyway, she spoke at the Emerging Technology Conference on this topic. And one of the points that she made is that as she travels around and talks to high school and college age students, she finds that although their elders point to them as examples of human potential. In other words, look at what these kids can do, right? They can have 14 IM windows open and listen to music and talk on the telephone and do their homework, right? And the sort of, if you will, grown-up perspective on that is, let's applaud this human potential. Being,
well, not me.
Right? Well, but,
you're not including me in the applause.
Yeah, but her point is that as she talks to these folks, she finds that, in fact, they feel oppressed by it more than...
You mean the kids or the parents?
Yeah, the kids feel oppressed by this and have been saying to her, we don't want to live like this. We can't sustain this.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, but because they're being rewarded for it, because
uh-huh.
in fact it's...
It's become culturally cool.
It's cool and it is not understood or... It's something that their elders are not capable of, you know, therefore they're actually being rewarded for doing this, although they themselves are perhaps sensing that it's you know, driving them crazy, it's unproductive, and so on. So, right, I mean, there's a natural sort of pendulum effect, and I think there's going to be some correction forthcoming.
Thank you, John. I feel much better.
On this point about machine mediation of all interaction, I have... the following argument in its favor, that one of the things we don't have as a consequence of living in industrialized society is very much opportunity to observe other people doing their work. So that, you know, I mean, thinking in just broad historical terms, that for thousands of years, it was the case that in your tribe or in your village, you saw what was going on right. in a pretty direct way. But then,
and even through the factories into the modern era.
If you were a kid stuck working in one of them, I suppose, yeah. But by sort of the middle of the last century, though, the experience was much more one of dad went off to do who knows what and returned at the end of the day. What was the work that dad, usually it was dad, did? Mm-hmm. It was a complete mystery. And so it struck me that one of the things we see happening now on the network, and in particular in the domain of open source software, is this degree of transparency in terms of what work is that hasn't existed for a long time. And so, you know, I argue that in a very real sense, if you're interested in software and you are a young person and you live anywhere on the planet and you have an internet connection, you can discover and join a real open source project. And
yes, I mean, the one thing that has really, really changed with open source is that it has made programming a social act,
yeah,
which it never was before.
Yeah,
you write some code and you get a reaction back.
Yeah,
in the days that I programmed, you had to use somebody as a programming dummy, if you remember that term.
Yep.
You know, or they don't know anything you're talking about. You just blah 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 blah, and as you talk, oh, okay, thanks, because you've solved it as you spoke. But these days, you know, programmers in the open source, they have a community.
Yep.
I don't know, you know, is it a friendly community? that's another question, I think. As time goes by, someone will observe how those interactions go. But it is a chance for programming to become a social act. I think you're right. If you're a programmer, technology has made your life better, which is where we started this conversation.
Yeah.
Being but, you know, for somebody who, I don't know, there are lots of other jobs out there, I don't know, they make sure inventories and plants are good. They sit in a room and they've got a computer and there may be a few people about, but it has not made their job more transparent. It's made their job more lonely, I would say.
Right.
Also, all these machine-mediated interactions have a way in which, well, think of people on a cell phone. They are not physically where they are anymore.
Yep.
So it's a way in which you're standing next to somebody, and it used to be if someone's not on the phone, they instinctively, without looking at you, kind of know you're there.
Mm-hmm.
And step aside. People could walk on the sidewalk and negotiate each other.
Mm-hmm.
No, you can't. The people around you are physically not present.
Yeah.
Their visual cortex is elsewhere.
Yeah.
And they're not sensing you. I noticed this acutely now that I've broken my foot and I'm on crutches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, walking along, and you would think that people, when you're on crutches, would make allowances for you, but the people on cell phones bang right into you. And so that does concern me, the sort of sense that it is now taking people outside of their physical environment, and there's a basic rudeness to this in a way that says, well, the person here in front of me is not worth my time.
I have a funny anecdote about that. I was in a sporting goods store a couple of months ago to buy some running shoes, and I was standing at the counter. And I just started to talk to the guy, and the phone rang. So he picked it up and switched into talking on the phone with this person. And it went on for a couple of minutes. And so I took out my cell phone and I called him. And he picked up the phone. Well, he put the person that he was talking to on hold,
right?
To talk
all
to me.
Waiting.
I said, "Hi, it's me. I'm standing in front of you."
Perfect. That's just perfect. It's kind of the revenge, isn't it?
Well, it was an odd moment.
But what did he think about that?
He was really embarrassed.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
So back to your point, though, that it in some ways has been true that people who are in information technology and in particular programmers have experienced modes of living and modes of working ahead of schedule.
We're the canaries in the mine.
Yeah, yeah. So, as you pointed out in something that I read, that in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, what was just routine for you, which is come into work, log in, check email, collaborate in shared information spaces, was completely outside the ken of everyone else. And
that was in the bug. Yeah.
And now that's kind of where most everyone is, in, at least in the industrialized first world.
We were creating the world so that everyone could have a programmer's life.
Yeah. So, and that's, like everything, got good and bad dimensions to it. But what I think sort of the next turn of that crank could be on the positive side is back to this notion of the opportunity for apprenticeship. Which I think is something that we really, in general, need to reinvent.
Right.
And so to the extent that in the world of, in particular, open source software development, it is the case that both the work product, which is to say the actual source code, but also the work process, which is to say the design discussions and the documents related to that, the test harnesses, and a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, that, that all of this is sitting out there transparently open to inspection by anyone. And so you can find out not only what is it like to be a programmer in the sense of coding a module, but what is it like to be a programmer in the sense of negotiating with a group who hold conflicting interests what the specification for some protocol should be, right? So there's a whole bunch of, you know, a whole range of kind of social and political skills, negotiation skills, and you know, all of that is out there in a way that is remarkably complete and remarkably accessible. And so
Just one thing I'd like to add to that, though. It's really not possible to write a module without an understanding of where it exists in the great world that will use that module.
Mm-hmm.
It's so, as an apprentice, that's why it's hard to apprentice. Because you might say, well, I think this module should work like this, but it's based on what? It has to be based on a pretty good idea of the whole environment around it.
Yeah.
Which is hard to learn.
Sure it is, but the way,
you can't just come in and there's a piece of, multitasking or, you know, some kind of multi-processing on the chip and, you know, just come in and say, gee, you know, I think that's too many locks. We should have fewer locks. I mean, unless you've really spent a lot of time on this, you know, this, you're not going to be very helpful in the discussion.
No, I agree, but a way that people enter that world is by noticing what's happening.
I see.
Right, associating or affiliating to the group that's doing that work, you know, being assigned relatively junior tasks, you know, you can begin to progress. And this is, I mean, you know, this is in fact a career path that exists in a very real way in that particular world as
that
a consequence of the fact that the, again, the work product and process are represented in forms that can be machine mediated effectively. And so to the extent that we buy into the idea that it is generally becoming a quote-unquote knowledge economy, it strikes me that maybe, again, what we're seeing here, at least I hope what we're seeing here, is evidence of something which is now only in effect for this weird little group, but will be in effect more broadly, you know, for lots of different professions which are increasingly knowledge-intensive and, you know, for which it would be increasingly useful to society at large to open up in ways that people can figure out, you know, what's it like to be a physical therapist? What's it like to be a city planner, right?
Exactly,
and, you know,
I
mean, you know, as opposed
to... That's true, I see. So you could get into some, you could be permitted to join some group of city planners and you watch their documents go back and forth and their emails and so forth. That would be a great idea. You know, if you'd interviewed and, you know, you could be like an intern.
Yeah.
An intern at a magazine.
Yeah. Because what we have now
That's
is basically,
idea.
You know, bring your daughter to work day.
Right.
Right. Which doesn't really cut it.
No.
You know?
It just gives her a physical, visual idea of where mommy is.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to go back to one thing you said about this knowledge economy. I read today, who did the thing, it was in the Times, that the United States now ranks 6th in competitiveness in the world. And I think it's because we don't manufacture things anymore. I mean, we're not going to have an automobile industry 5 years from now. And China is on the rise in the world. Why? Because it's the manufacturing center of the world. So I think part of what's the problem in our whole economy is that we have bought in too deeply into the idea that, well, we're all just, you know, what's of value here is what's in our head.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, the idea of software engineering is to build something, and the engineering part of it is to actually build a thing and make it work, and just that whole ethos is, I don't see it here. I mean, why? How can we be an economy that doesn't build anything? I mean, God forbid there's a war. How do we build boats and planes and tractors? I mean, I'm serious about this. I do worry about this. I when I see that, why can't Americans make good cars? There's no reason, and you know, everyone keeps saying, oh, it's all these workers who have these pensions and health care. That's true, but the management of the company is foolish. They make too many brands. If they would just sit down and decide, we're going to make 5 really fantastic cars, it could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I just cannot understand why we are in a situation in this country where we do not value that sort of process. The whole notion of engineering and construction and building, manufacturing, it has lost its allure as a shining example of what an economy should be, I think, to our peril.
I would completely agree. My hope there is that, in general, what will happen or what could happen is that we see that global connectivity doesn't always mean being somewhere else. It can also mean being where you are in a much richer way, in a richer way meaning not just economically. This is a hard idea to put across, and something that I've been working on explicitly for a while now, is to try to get people to think in terms of the local effects of the global internet. So just looking around in my own community, I see enormous missed opportunity in terms of how government and citizens could work together better, how citizens could collaborate on public works in much more effective ways, how education could be radically improved. And it's almost as though there's no appreciation for the fact that it's a global network, but you can have a local overlay on that global network and use all of that infrastructure that's available in a very focused way to achieve very specific local social and economic goals. And that's it's a case I am trying to make. I'm having a hard time making it. And I'm not sure exactly why, because it seems pretty obvious to me.
Well, come up with a prototype in your community. I think that would be the best way to do it.
Yeah, I've done a few, actually.
Are you still in Peterborough?
No, I'm in Keene. It's about 20...
Well, I know. Yeah, I went to Keene. I had a fellowship at McDowell. Sorry,
right.
I didn't know
you
were still in the area.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I know Keene. Yes, it's a nice little town.
Yeah, it is. And there's a ton that could be happening here that hasn't happened. I am not the only person that I know now who lives here but works through the internet, really effectively works elsewhere. But what that means is that I'm physically present here in my neighborhood, and I know a growing number of other folks who can say the same thing. So one of the possibilities that this presents, I argue, is that it becomes possible to recolonize the neighborhood so that the neighborhood is now no longer a place that vacates between the hours of 9 and 5, but a place that is inhabited between the hours of 9 and 5.
People are sitting home, each one before a computer or two.
Well, but, you know, yes and no, because so here's what happens is,
Or they take their laptop into the coffee shop. Or
not just that. I'm specifically talking about the effect on the neighborhood. So the analogy that I make is, when I was a kid, my parents moved into a brand new suburb of Philadelphia, and everybody on the street bought at around the same time, and they were all about the same age. They all had kids around the same age. And
all ran in and out of everybody's houses.
Well, actually...
That's what we did as kids.
Yeah, well, kind of. But even more, what happened is that this group sort of took a decision to not fence the backyards.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a stretch up and down the block of something like 8 or 9 backyards that formed a contiguous... Effectively, it was a park.
Mm.
And it was also the case, because this was a long time ago, that you could be guaranteed that there'd be one or more moms at home who were just known to be kind of keeping an eye out through the kitchen window that looked out over the backyards. And so there was a sense of that people were present in the community and kids weren't observed by adults in inappropriate ways. And that is such a rare experience right now, but we've kind of had that. So because we're here, my wife actually works out of our home too. Our home has been the social focus for my kids' gangs of friends.
And so they know you're around.
They're here instead of somewhere where we don't see what's happening. And so we do see what's happening. Plus, the other kids' parents know that there's someplace where someone is there, is listening, is watching, and so on.
No, that's a really good, it's the kind of thing I have not heard before. That's very interesting, John.
I think it is. And I know that the potential for this is growing. And I've actually read that officially telecommuting is either not on the rise or even declining, depending on what you read. But I also know that unofficially, there are many, many people who I talk to who say, yeah, I'm working at home today. You know, and it's not because it's not because there's an official telecommute policy at their job that says, well, you can have one day or 3 days a week. You know, it's just that this is something that people do because, among other things, it's becoming more recognized that periods of focused concentration away from the office are how a lot of people get a lot of their work done.
Well, since I am here all the time, everyone in the building who has a problem with how things are going knocks on my door. And this is both good and bad. I mean, it's good for the building, knowing that there's somebody here who, you know, is willing to take responsibility for, you know, my God, there's a leak, you know, what should we do? Like, I mean, they could do it themselves. We have an emergency number, but somehow it makes everyone feel better to know that they're sort of a block ante.
Yeah.
That would be me. It's rewarding in one sense that I know all my neighbors, not all of them, but most of them. You know, these are condos, lots of other places. People don't know who's around them. So I know hordes of people in the building. On the other hand, it's also oppressive. I mean, do you sometimes feel like, oh, God, I'm responsible for all these children. I have all this work to do. But I think you're right. I grew up that way, too. I mean, no one worried about us. I think part of it was that people didn't worry about the sort of crimes people encounter today with children and all that. That may be overblown, I don't know, but people are afraid more than they used to be.
Yeah, that's true.
But I grew up in the situation as you did. You know, there was always a mommy around.
Yeah.
Nobody worried. You know, my mother went off to go grocery shopping or whatever, and, you know, she just went.
Yeah.
I said, oh, I'll be at Susie's or, you know, down the block, or there was always someone about. So it's a wonderful idea, right, because now it's not mummies, it's people at home working. That's very interesting.
Well, I'm glad I brought that up.
I've really enjoyed this discussion.
Thank you, me too.